Okay, I don't remember exactly what the thing said. I'm just trying to sound smart before I talk about special feelings. The piece stuck with me, whether it had any merit or not, because I was totally one of those girls. I loved the baby-faced new kids on the block, but felt wholly creeped out when they changed their name to NKOTB and started growing facial hair. When Jonathan Taylor Thomas cut his hair short enough that it no longer fell into his eyes, it was a betrayal. Zach Morris was far preferable to AC Slater. Slater was the one with the rippling muscles, but outside of lifting heavy furniture, what on earth did that have to do with anything? The thing the article got wrong, in my opinion, was that I didn't feel threatened or intimidated by masculine guys. I felt nothing. They didn't stir something in me that I wasn't ready to deal with. They didn't stir anything at all. They seemed as attractive as the side of a building. Not that I knew exactly what I wanted to do with, say, Devin Sawa and Casper either. Even my tender-faced teen crushes inspired pretty elementary goals. I knew I found them interesting, I knew I liked their faces, and I knew if we met, like if maybe they moved to Maine to escape the pressures of stardom, I'd want them to like me. Beyond that, I wasn't sure what was supposed to happen. And once I found out, I was so nauseated that my daydreams would only reach the point where I kissed the object of my affection, aka the middle brother from Three Ninjas, before the dream cut out like a busted VHS and started again from the beginning. I went through two phases of trying to win the affection of boys. While we were still young enough that sexual contact was off the table, I waged a full-out assault on the seemingly impenetrable interests of the male. I was short, I was loud, I wore the same thing to school for days at a time. Where was I going wrong? During that blissful period before I had to think about sex, I liked to present myself as boy crazy. I did like boys, both boys that I knew and the appropriately feminine boys in Teen Beat, but I played up being boy crazy because it seemed like the trait of a pretty popular girl. In third grade, I took a quiz in 17 Magazine and brought it to school. I'm totally boy crazy, according to this. It's so embarrassing. Look. I'd looked at the answer key prior to marking each question, but I thought my classmates would be duly impressed. My teacher took a look at the magazine and cautioned me to curb this quality as I got older. What is she talking about? The whole point of this is to seem like a cool older girl. It took me years to realize she was warning me not to become a slut. For as much as I thought about boys, which wasn't as much as I pretended but was still a lot, they did not seem interested in holding up their end of the bargain. They were supposed to stride up to me in the cafeteria, push Libby Perino and her shiny black hair to the side, and ask me to the school dance. But we didn't have school dances in elementary school, and none of the boys I knew wanted to talk to me anyway. Wait, that's it. By fifth grade, I cracked a major development in strategy. I needed to get boys to talk to me. I wasn't pretty, but I could make them like me through the magic of conversation, or at least trick them into revealing some actionable knowledge and go from there. My current crush was Matty Booth. He had dirty blonde hair and seemed dangerous in that way that only a fifth grade boy from Maine can. The only thing I knew about him was that he liked gory movies, so I spent a few weeks letting my older brother pick the movie rentals for a change. We'd tell our parents we got Fern Gully again, and wait until they went to bed to sneak downstairs and watch his selection. I forced myself to sit through horror films and action films and pulp fiction. I knew I was unprepared to see some of them. Pulp fucking fiction! But I was going to turn myself into Matty Booth's dream girl, damn it. One day he stayed after class because he hadn't done his homework. My boy was such a rebel! And I lingered and pretended to clean up my desk. I ever so casually struck up a conversation. Oh, Maddie, you know the other day, 3 weeks ago, when you were talking about the grossest movies you'd ever seen? Cue Maddie looking up at me, cautiously intrigued. Well, I've got a really gross one for you. Have you seen Outbreak? Outbreak isn't gross. It's not even scary. Yeah, totally. Okay, so talking to boys had not been a success. But I didn't blame myself for not watching movies that were gross enough or scary enough for this boy's taste. If anything, I walked away thinking, wow, talking to boys is not that fun. Or at least, talking to a boy with whom I have nothing in common and who has no interest in me is not that fun. New development. I just won't bother with boys who don't like me or any of the things I like. I've learned my lesson and I'll definitely never make the same mistake again. In middle school, I discovered that liking boys who didn't like me back was all I'd be emotionally capable of for a very long time. Middle school was also when I went through a phase of liking exclusively non-Caucasian boys. They didn't like me back either. Any boy of any ethnicity other than my own was automatically the object of my love. In case you forgot, we're in Maine at this point, and the handful of racially diverse young men I met at middle school immediately struck me as exceptional. I barely knew any of them. I was just attracted to them from afar. Looking back, it's pretty plain that what I liked was how different they seemed. I was desperate to be around anything and anyone outside of what I'd experienced in my life so far. One could even argue that I wasn't attracted to the person, but I was actually fetishizing their race, but definitely don't listen to that because it's dangerously close to an intellectually sound argument where I come off sort of racist. All I knew was that in sixth grade, Shaheen was beautiful, an Iranian, and so much cooler than me. Seventh grade was interrupted when I moved to Yonkers with my dad for the duration of high society, so I never developed a crush on anyone at school. In New York, I did have a crush on the boy who played young Simba in The Lion King, but since I was only in the room with him one time and our parents were there, our love did not blossom. My friend Nora from The Sound of Music and I often discussed that great mystery that looms before all adolescent girls. Sex. We talked about sex a lot. Not boys. I apologize if this freaks out any parents. But we did not talk about boys and how cute Ryan's new haircut was or how dreamy the boys in 98 Degrees were. We talked about sex. What we'd heard about it, what it would be like, how you were supposed to do it. We were on a mission to compile everything we'd ever heard about all things sex-related. Condoms, porn, hookers, first base, second base, third base, and by the way, when the hell were we gonna get boobs? If any parents are still with me, the good news is we were way more interested in figuring it out than actually doing it. We were like theoretical sex engineers. Oh, theoretical sex engineer, title of my next book! The other good news is that we were pathetic. We were the blind leading the blind. She told me about a pornographic comic book she'd seen and the offensive joke it contained about Hispanic women's pubic hair. I told her that a girl from my church had seen Stephen King's Thinner, and in one scene the wife leaned into the husband's lap and moved her head up and down. So, blowjobs involved moving, I guess? It's adorable in a super uncomfortable way, right? I'm grateful that we were wondering the same things and that we were both hungry to put a name to our feelings and to have someone reflect them back. I didn't know how lucky I was until I went home and received many blank stares from friends who were not interested in or prepared for talking about sex out loud. This was the last time I would ever be ahead of the curve sexually. In fact, I pretty much plateaued there for the next 6 years. This was only a noticeable problem once I got to high school and phrases like fooling around and hooking up were no longer empty braggadocio. When kids I knew started to go past first base, I felt nervous and excited. It was like waiting in line for a roller coaster. If you'd seen a sex ed video about how the roller coaster was probably going to ruin your life. For me, the nervousness usually outweighed the excitement. Now that potentially seeing each other naked was part of the package, I would still try to court the male and then run for my life at the smallest sign of interest. I was the romantic equivalent of the annoying friend who goes to the haunted house but chickens out and eats candy apples outside until it's over. Also me. I don't know if my aversion came from the suspicion that I'd make a fool of myself, insecurity about my body, or just the fear that it would hurt. I could sense I wasn't anatomically ready when most girls were. Maybe the emotional part was waiting for the physical part to catch up. It certainly wasn't that I didn't have the feelings, but I was dealing with those on my own. I was conflicted to say the least, and it didn't help that I found a pamphlet under the seat in the auditorium that proclaimed, "No one likes a tease," but I still sought to ensnare a boy. Sure, the odds were against me. But there had to be at least one guy I could trick into settling for a girl who wore a training bra and was terrified of sex. There was Andy, who had long eyelashes and was so cerebral and self-aware that even at 14, I deemed him pretentious. Intellectual insults were my high school version of pushing someone on the playground. If I thought he deserved the label, it clearly didn't bother me very much. I followed him around during his free period so often I almost failed the class I was supposed to be in during that time block. We flirted a lot and kissed a few times, and I was never sure if we didn't get together because he didn't want to, or because I would get that queasy what-if-he-wants-to-see-me-naked feeling whenever he showed more than a passing interest. I met Hunter at a rave that my brother snuck me into. He was slight and kind of gorgeous. He wore a bandana with the Puerto Rican flag, I suspect to compensate for his misleading white kid name, and he told my friend Lindsay that I had a nice ass. Who talked like that? Even putting that memory on paper gives me butterflies. I had never met someone so forward. He asked for my number. What are we, in a movie? And called a couple of times, but stopped after the third phone call, when the awkward pauses led him to ask, "Am I bothering you?" "No, you're not bothering me. This is the most exciting thing that's happened to me ever." But I didn't say that. I was stuck in the limbo of wanting a fifth-grade relationship but not being able to acknowledge it, even to myself. I mean, I wanted to do something before I graduated, but not everything. And the only thing worse than having sex or being the virgin loser forever would be having a mature conversation with a guy I liked about waiting until I was ready. The world would have ended. Even though I remember high school as a never-ending barrage of rejection, I would feel dishonest if I didn't acknowledge that there were guys who liked me, or at least one. Noah left a rose by my locker on Valentine's Day and had to trick me into walking past it because my locker was on the third floor and I didn't use it. I panicked, hugged him, and said no thank you and walked away before I had to look at his face. He was remarkably cool about it and made sure things didn't get weird. We stayed close friends throughout high school, and when he asked me on a Friday, "You wouldn't want to go to prom on Saturday, would you?" I wrongly assumed that the late ask and casual tone meant as friends. I was grossed out and frankly kind of hurt when he drove me to a motel after the dance. I had to pull the old phone call to mom where I loudly whine, "Why not?" and say my mom's being a bitch and I have to go home. An excellent tool for getting kids out of situations they don't want to be in. My mom always played along and I would recommend this trick to any parent. Some bitter boys reading this might accuse me of friend zoning, but I'd like to say that even if a girl has misinterpreted a situation that someone else thinks is obvious, she does not owe her male friends anything. Footnote. Needless to say, this applies to every arrangement of gender and orientation. I mentioned males pressuring females because that's been my only personal experience of it, but it turns out my personal journey isn't an infallible barometer of the entire human experience. Weird, right? No one knew me well. He knew I was a virgin in every possible sense and that I didn't take it lightly. But the motel implied that he hoped we could fool around even though we weren't dating. He was a nice boy who did something skeezy and it sucked. We stayed in touch for a while after I moved to LA. In fact, he and a friend once stayed on my couch for a week and left a lovely thank you note on the refrigerator the morning they left. I woke up and saw the note and felt guilty for being irritated by the end of the visit. Then my roommate stuck his head out of our bathroom. "There's an enormous shit sitting in the toilet. Maybe you're just destined to lose touch with some people." I guess we're doing this, or how does this scene end? I met Landon through the internet. No, not on the internet like some kind of freak. No, I met him the normal way. Heather, my hot blonde friend, met Brent, Landon's hot blonde friend, on MySpace, and those two introduced us around the time they were getting tired of having hot blonde dry humping sessions. Because hot blondes need breakup wingmen, I guess. Landon was attractive and he knew Anchorman by heart, which at the time passed for really funny. He was kind of a jock, so I wanted to turn my nose up at him, as I did with all jocks, so I could let the world know that not being with a handsome athletic type was my choice. But he was persistent and a genuine romantic, and when I weighed my options logically, it seemed silly not to date him. I wanted to escape the wasteland of being the 19-year-old loner, and to the naked eye, this guy was perfect. He was polite and punctual, and my friends liked him a lot, and he was very handsome. One day during our courtship, he dropped off a novelty trucker hat on my doorstep. I know we've all figured out that novelty trucker hats are hideous, but it was cool at the time. Today, that would be like a guy giving you a spiked ear cuff or a turtleneck crop top, or for future editions, a novelty trucker hat, because fashion is cyclical. It was sweet and original, and I could resist no more. Let's be real. He had a pulse and he wanted to be my boyfriend. On our first official date, he took me to a trendy restaurant. I rolled my eyes over how LA it all was. I'd never been somewhere so stylish, which should have made me nervous. But being openly disdainful of anything cool is in my comfort zone, so I still had a couple moves at my disposal. I really shine in a Taco Bell parking lot with a water bottle full of vodka, but I could work with this. After dinner, we went back to my apartment and talked with my roommates for the appropriate length of time before retiring to my room and crawling into the luxury of my twin bed. We fooled around for a while. I employed a few suggestions from the early chapters of Guide to Getting It On. No one recoiled in horror at any point. A successful first date level encounter. I got up to go to the bathroom, and when I came back, the first thing that went through my mind was, why is he still here? Oh, I was thrilled. I was so proud of myself. I was still in control. Just because we'd hooked up didn't mean he had the upper hand. I was still powerful and hard-hearted, and I could walk away from this whenever I felt like it. The next morning, we drove to breakfast, and I told him as much, just so he knew the score. "Okay, creepy," he said, and turned up the radio. I assessed the situation. We'd had a nice dinner, some playful banter, and fooling around that was in no way objectionable. All right, world, let's do this. Let's have me a damn boyfriend. I looked at dating him as a kind of personal experiment. Something about him being a jock or liking nice restaurants or having the stench of family money despite his studio apartment made me feel like this would be a safe bet for me. In theory, I should have been intimidated. Instead, I felt superior. He'd also never met a girl as bossy as me, and knowing that emboldened me even more. I am a boss bitch, and this dude is too basic to hurt me. Neither of those slang terms were around yet, but that's like the vibe I had. I'm a jerk for feeling superior to anyone ever, and that was equally true of Landon, despite being the kind of guy who saved up to buy the exact suit Ashton Kutcher wore on the cover of GQ. I made fun of him a lot. Luckily, that's the kind of thing that comes across as playful at 19, But Landon turned out to be fun, caring, and seriously right brain smart. After a satisfactory couple of months, I felt more committed to this dating experiment and started subconsciously, and sometimes consciously, making a bizarre coming-of-age checklist. Had I learned nothing from my beads and lipstick pen pal episode? It was mostly stuff I'd seen in movies, and I knew it was stupid, but every milestone gave me a sense that I was approaching normalcy. Nothing in my life was going especially well at that point, but if the guy I was seeing burned a CD for me, check. It felt like I was becoming a standard American adult. He asked me to take a road trip to meet his parents. Okay, if I meet your parents, would that make us boyfriend and girlfriend? I thought we were already boyfriend and girlfriend. No, we're not, but would you agree that me meeting your parents would make us officially boyfriend and girlfriend? Yeah, creepy, I guess it would. Okay, great, I'm looking forward to it. The road trip hit a lot of items on my imaginary relationship checklist. We shared painful childhood memories during the long stretches of the drive. Check. We took pictures kissing in front of national landmarks. Check. And he showed me his childhood bedroom. Check. It was like a real relationship. All of it was genuinely meaningful to me, but the checklist was always there, giving me little bonus rushes of validation. After I met his parents and we got back to LA, I addressed a big unchecked box. Okay, we're boyfriend and girlfriend now, so we should have sex, right? Landon had had sex before and always assured me that he was fine with what we were doing. Gently, he said, I'd love to, but only if you want to and only if you think you're ready. He put his hand on my arm. Ugh, don't make this weird. Let's just go have sex. Sex was great. Why hadn't anybody told me? I mean, it hurt. It actually hurt a lot. And not just for a moment the first time. I'm looking at you, erotic novels. But, okay, it was crazy. Sex wasn't like the other stuff at all. Each time we'd finish, actually, the first few times no one finished, per se, but, you know, we'd stop. I'd talk a mile a minute. God, I wish I could explain what it feels like, but I can't put it into words because, like, a person is in my body. You're in my body. And I never really thought about it before, but nothing's ever been in my body, you know? Like, I can't just open a hatch in my leg and put something in there, you know? What does it feel like to you? It feels really good. Oh, that's not what I mean. You are the worst. Tomorrow, can we try a different position? I felt alive. I didn't just feel different. I felt like I had superpowers. And I definitely felt like I was in the club. I saw a cool-looking girl in line at Starbucks and thought, I'll bet that girl has sex. And I have sex, too. We get it. Like, I could go up to her and be like, oh, hey, do you have sex? And she'd be like, yeah. And I'd be like, yeah, me too. I totally know what it feels like. The sex checklist was the most egregious of all. Most people I knew had been at it for years, and I needed to catch up. I wanted to check off all the greatest hits. I barreled through every cliche, and it turns out a lot of it wasn't that sexy, but we both pretended that it was. We did the blindfold thing. We did the whipped cream and chocolate sauce thing. I bought a tacky red bustier for Valentine's Day and fuzzy green handcuffs for St. Patrick's. Oh, and the guide. I put that baby into well-organized action. When Landon would question something, I'd pull out the guide and point out that according to a book I bought in a West Hollywood thrift store called Out of the Closet, plenty of couples do it. Shower sex. Check. Sex with ice. Check. Sex in the back of a parked car like teenagers in a movie about the 1950s. Check. I wanted to ask if he was circumcised because I couldn't tell. But my roommate Peter told me, dude, you can't ask him that. Don't ask him that. I don't know why I wasn't allowed to ask. I guess because it would make me look stupid or make him uncomfortable. But I didn't know how else I was supposed to find out. After we broke up, I didn't see another penis for a year. And by that time, I couldn't retroactively compare the two. So I still don't know. Aside from that, I was in the trenches, having fun, learning a lot. Landon and I were both more interested in the other person's pleasure. Not because we were selfless people, but because we got validation from it. It led to some energetic but fruitless evenings. Anyway, the sex was a blast and the relationship was going great. Well, it was going okay. Well, it was tolerable. At the end of the day, we were just incompatible, which we wouldn't figure out for a few more months, and better off as friends, which we wouldn't figure out for a year after breaking up. But come on, we were living the dream. Going on coffee runs in the morning, finding ways to kill time in the afternoon, having sex before bed, being normal. About 4 months into dating, we were casually having the kind of philosophical conversation that no 19-year-old should be allowed to have without supervision. And Landon said, well, sex before marriage is a sin. At this point, in my opinion, religion played a convenient role in Landon's life. The hypocrisy bothered me, and I liked to debate him on it. This was so flagrant, it was delicious. Excuse me? Then what the hell have we been doing? Guys, I wasn't even that mad. It was just too silly for words. Well, no, I mean, I used to believe sex before marriage was a sin. Now I think it's okay as long as the people are in love. I'm not in love with you. We've never said I love you. Are you in love with me? Admittedly, I wasn't exactly setting him up to say it, even if he had been. Okay, no, but we care about each other. I rolled my eyes. He was digging himself to China. Then he said, and you always initiate it. I stared at him. What does that mean? What is that? Some kind of Adam and Eve temptation complex? A term I made up on the spot. Are you saying that you want to be having less sex? Or just that when we have sex, it's my fault? Need I remind you that you'd slept with 7 girls before we met? I'm just saying that it's one thing if we can't help ourselves. You don't have to be so, like, ready and willing. I'm not saying we wouldn't be having sex at all. It's just you don't always have to initiate it. So what? You'd prefer it if I had to be convinced? He chose his words carefully. Okay, it's just that the chase is kind of gone. It's kind of a turnoff. Huh, I thought. I wonder how much therapy I'll need to undo the damage from this moment. The origin of his logic had taken a turn, but I couldn't even be bothered to point it out. The behavior that I thought was adventurous and awesome and earning me girlfriend of the damn century points was making him lose interest in fucking me because I seemed too available? 3 months ago, I was terrified of being outed as a virgin freak. Now I'd had sex with all of one person. Somehow I was getting slut-shamed. I'm not interested in pretending to be a reluctant participant because you think girls who like sex are a turnoff. If you think girls are supposed to object to sex until they find themselves incapable of resisting your magic penis, fuck you. Unless this is a roleplay fantasy between consenting adults, in which case I'll go to the wizarding world of Harry Potter and grab some props right now. We fought for a while, he backtracked a lot, and we made up. I don't think he meant for it to make me feel the way that it did. Honestly, the worst thing that happened was I wrote some truly appalling poetry about it. No one was going to make me think women were supposed to hate sex. I knew I was right, which is a comfortable place for me, even when I'm really pissed off. But it rattled me. I found it troubling because I wondered if other guys felt the same way. We didn't last much longer. He drove to my apartment one afternoon, on a day that I'd miraculously bothered to do my hair and makeup, and said he felt like it wasn't working anymore. At first I thought I could just ignore that it was happening. I kept going about business in my room. You're right. I need to make more of an effort. We should hang out with your friends more. I know that. No, I don't think that's it. I just... Can you sit down? Okay. Shit. We're really doing this. And it sucks. But at least I look half cute. Our relationship had started as an experiment in adulthood, but I was really invested now. Oh, real emotional investment. Check! And he was dumping me. Deep breaths. Obviously a breakup wasn't on my checklist, but I wanted to make the best of a bad situation. So, I said, what happens now? He was giving me this horrible, concerned face. The pity stung worse than the rejection. I wanted to punch him. Well, we can stay friends if you want. I know I'd like to, but I'll understand if you... No, I mean, what happens right now? Like, how do you finish a breakup? Like, how does this scene end? Okay. A word here. I'm not some sociopath who can't tell the difference between real life and a movie. I was just using scene to differentiate the immediate situation from our hypothetical future dynamic. That said, my deliberately robotic demeanor probably confirmed that he was right to cut and run. He'd gotten the ball rolling. I wasn't planning to change his mind. I just needed to know how to wrap it up. Still, he was taken aback. I don't know. Do you want me to stay for a while? So we can make pity faces at each other for half an hour? I'd rather you just leave. I was being vindictive, but give me a break. I was getting dumped. Okay. He was doing a good job of looking appropriately bewildered by my callous response. Whatever, I reasoned. I totally let that guy off the hook. Easiest breakup ever. I cried after he left. And it wasn't just something I needed to get under my belt. It sucked, and my ego hurt. That night, my roommate stayed home with me. We watched bad movies and ate cookie dough straight from the tube and talked about what a jerk my ex-boyfriend was. Check. I went ahead and hated Landon passionately, but only because I thought it was another requirement of my relationship experiment. If you'd asked me about him while we were still dating, I doubt I would have said, I can't get enough of him, and I feel great about where our relationship is heading. Half of my brain knew it was a blessing. The other half screamed, how dare he dump me? That feeling only lasted about a week, and then I got comfortable knowing that I had an ex-boyfriend. Talking about my ex was just another thing that normalized me, so I counted it as a win. The lingering confusion about how liking sex with my boyfriend could be a turnoff messed with me for a little while, but no more so than the virgin whore stuff that's everywhere in our culture. The hard part is that Landon is a good guy, and sometimes good people can still hurt each other. I didn't have sex again for a year, but based on who I was hanging out with during that period of my life, I doubt I missed anything spectacular. Lesson for young men. If you want your eventual wife to be excited about sucking your dick for 40 years, Don't create a generation of women who think enthusiasm about sex is a bad thing. I ran into Landon about a year after we broke up and immediately realized I didn't hate him at all, and we've been close friends since. His favorite thing to do is drag me to Starbucks even though he knows I don't drink coffee anymore. My favorite thing to do is whisper, "He beats me," to the barista when Landon turns his back. He does not find it funny at all. I went to his wedding last year. When his wife walked down the aisle, he cried his ass off. It was beautiful. During the ceremony, the minister talked about having a healthy sexual relationship and how the marital bed was a place for love and honesty and respect. And I was glad that religion and intimacy were finding a balance in Landon's life. Then, Pastor Marital Bed McGee expounded on the subject for another 7 minutes and made everyone tremendously uncomfortable. I caught up with his parents and his bride. I took pictures of the newlyweds on my phone as though they weren't going to have enough. I refused to dance. I said my goodbyes and walked through a gorgeous field toward my car. Everything seemed wonderfully strange. I'd just been to my ex's wedding, and I was contented in the knowledge that he was so happy and found such a good fit. Check. He's just not that interesting. The summer I turned 21, I dated a musician named Connor. Well, I thought he was a musician and that we were dating. He thought he was a screenwriter who dabbled in music and that we were hooking up and not labeling things because labels cause drama. He was 28 and something of an introvert. I took this to mean that he was deep and artistic and probably judged me for talking as much as I do. Once we broke up, I realized it just meant he was kind of boring and probably judged me for talking as much as I do. This was my first lesson in "He's just not that into you." Sure, that episode of Sex and the City had aired and the book had been written, but guess what? TV writers can't learn your life lessons for you. I plowed ahead, actually having conversations with friends that looked like this. Do you think I'm coming across overeager? Do I need to play it more cool with him? Maybe. Why don't you just not call him for a while and wait for him to get in touch with you? Well, if I didn't call him at all, we'd never talk again. Oh, sweet Anna. When we first started hooking up, I was 20. He would play in clubs and bars at night, which meant that at first it was simply unavoidable that he'd spend most of the night without me and invite me over once he got home. I reasoned that it wasn't a booty call if the law was keeping us apart. A fake ID was out of the question, since I looked like a guilty fifth grader on the best days. So at a certain point, my only goal became to not get dumped before I turned 21. Then I'd really be able to get my hooks in. Oh God, it hurts to say. Looking back, it's hard for me to understand what I was doing. Why on earth would I pursue someone who clearly had no interest in me? It's not like we had fun together. The man didn't like me so much as tolerate me. I suppose the easy answer is that I hadn't had a decent relationship yet, so I thought bagging a cool and attractive male was the whole objective. We would have made a terrible couple. But his indifference blinded me to all the red flags. He drove a BMW but slept on a futon. He watched the History Channel like it was a reliable source. Part of me knew I was only determined to bring him around because he was resisting me, but the idea of acknowledging the rejection hurt more than pretending it might be going somewhere. I'd been so nervous when we met and only got increasingly nervous as I tried to win his affection that as a result, I have no idea what I was even like around him. If I could see tape of us interacting, I doubt I'd recognize myself. Who was I supposed to be making him fall in love with? My strategy was just to be agreeable. I had this fantasy of a braver, parallel universe version of me, but I was the most sterile, inoffensive version instead. When he said things to me like, "You use humor as a defense mechanism," I should have said, "Yeah, and you use pithy proclamations that let you maintain your sense of superiority as a fucking defense mechanism." Instead, I clenched my teeth and made a plan to be more serious from then on. We saw each other sporadically. Sometimes I'd send a breezy text, start a casual conversation, and spend the day staring at my phone until he got the hint and invited me over. Our group of mutual friends would get together a couple times a week, and I'd invariably end up going home with him after those nights, so I did not miss one group hangout that summer. At the time, this group seemed impossibly cool to me as well. I'm sure their allure was wrapped up in my desire to stay connected to him. Also, I don't know if being motivated by amazing sex would have made my desperation more pathetic or less, but I cannot say that was part of it. Nothing about the sex was bad, but after a month or two, I still hadn't, you know, arrived. Mom, I'm sorry, but I told you to skip this chapter. If you're hearing this, it's your own fault. Obviously, in my pitiful state, I wasn't disturbed by this orgasm drought for myself. I wanted to orgasm for him. I assumed that if I wasn't enjoying myself enough, he'd end up feeling discouraged and less interested in doing it at all. If he was rocking my world, he'd want to do it more, right? For all I know, he wouldn't have noticed if I'd turned to stone mid-thrust, but I figured it couldn't hurt. So, no masturbation. Cut out all solo activity. I'll abstain from climaxing, and eventually he will have to make me. 6 weeks went by. 6 weeks. And I was getting nothing supplementally speaking. I was sticking to my guns. I was the master of my domain. Finally, I went to his apartment one night and knew it was going to happen. I was on a hair trigger. 6 weeks. Oddly enough, or not odd at all since I hadn't come in 6 weeks, I got there during actual sex, which had never happened before. Now, creepy sex checklist aside, I was pretty damn inexperienced at this point, so this wasn't some huge accomplishment. It was more like a statistical inevitability. As we lay on his futon, I thought I'd tell him. So hey, first time I've had an orgasm during that whole situation. I raised my hand up for a high five. Up top! He chuckled sardonically and shook his head. You know, you could say like, wow, I've never had an orgasm from doing that before. You're the first. It should be a nice thing to hear. Was this dude using his therapist voice to tell me how to better stroke his ego after sex? I should have said, I haven't come in 6 weeks. A mammogram could have brought me to screaming orgasm, so you really shouldn't be smug. But instead, I clenched my teeth and scolded myself for ruining this moment I'd worked so hard for. As the weeks went on, I alternately gained and lost ground. He had some setbacks professionally, and he opened up to me about some of his fears and insecurities. This is awesome, I thought gleefully as I held him. A couple of weeks later, he was still feeling down. I offered to come over early one morning and cook him breakfast. This was partially a gesture, something to make him feel cared for, and partially because he was so strapped for cash, I knew he'd appreciate a free batch of groceries. He taught me how to make his favorite breakfast burrito, and I went to the Gelson's Market by my apartment to pick up everything we needed. Normally, I walked to Gelson's every morning to buy a lone power bar, but today, the checkout girl saw my basket. The tortillas, the eggs, the spices. She noted the change in my purchase and commented, "Trying something new?" "Oh, yeah," I paused. "I'm making breakfast for my boyfriend." What was the harm in saying it, right? It felt like Connor and I were probably heading there anyway, and as far as she knew, I was perfectly deserving of having the guy I'd been seeing for months accept the title of boyfriend. Unlike, say, all my friends, this girl had no reason to believe I was kidding myself. She smiled back at me and nodded conspiratorially. "Yes," I thought, "this is adorable. How quaint am I? Clumsily attempting to cook breakfast for my boyfriend. Like something out of a movie, I'd burn the first batch, he'd laugh, and I'd smack his arm. Yes, Gelson's lady, that's exactly what's going on here." I made the breakfast and he was grateful, but it wasn't quite how I pictured it. We fooled around and he made another helpful suggestion for how my post-blowjob behavior could be more affectionate or make him more comfortable or some shit. He had somewhere to be that afternoon, so we both headed out. I was in the car waiting to make a left-hand turn when my phone rang. It was him. He never called me first, especially not so soon after saying goodbye. I snatched the phone out of the cup holder and answered, "Hi, stalker. Just can't leave me alone, can you?" "Nice one, Anna. Perfect play." "I was just behind you. You're doing my most hated thing. When people turn left onto Sweetser but don't signal, so no one knows why you've stopped, I just had to go around you." I thought he was calling to say thank you for breakfast or tell me something funny he'd just seen that made him think of me, or maybe just to say it was nice to see me and could we hang out again tonight. He was calling to critique my driving. Why was I trying to spend more time with this person? I didn't even enjoy his company. What is wrong with 20-year-old girls? I debated even telling this part of the story because I hate admitting that I forgot to signal. But on the upside, it shows what a spineless doormat I was shaping up to be. So it stays. When I finally turned 21, it didn't change our dynamic as much as I'd hoped it would. He started showing interest in a new girl in the group named Erica, and I could feel him pulling away even more. The next time we had a vague talk about what we were doing, he seemed to debate himself Smeagol Gollum style in front of me. Well, we get along. I mean, we don't ever fight. I'm not saying I want to be with anyone else right now. I guess I just don't want to miss out on any opportunities. I should have screamed, "I'm the opportunity, you asshat!" But I clenched my teeth and convinced myself once again that I didn't need a label. Before I left, I at least managed to ask the question. "Okay, so you don't want to be with someone else, but I have to ask. Erica, is there something there that I should be worried about?" He furrowed his eyebrows more in comic surprise than anger. "Erica the brunette? Barrett's friend? No, I'm not even attracted to that girl. I think that girl has a boyfriend." It was enough for me. I figured a guy who secretly liked a girl might protest that she had a boyfriend as a cover-up, but if he hoped they might get together at some point, he wouldn't bother saying he wasn't attracted to her, or call her that girl. Twice. Yes, listener, I know where this is going. You're far better at everything than I am. A few weeks later, he came over and broke up with me, I cried. So much. It was hideously embarrassing. What had happened to me? I'd handled my first breakup like a champ. This guy so obviously wasn't into me. We weren't ever really together in the first place, and I was behaving like a messy trophy wife who'd just been told the prenup was ironclad. He wasn't some monster. He was very sensitive about it and put up with a lot of waterworks from a girl who claimed over and over she was fine with just having fun. Over the following days, the finality of being dumped started to feel like a relief. It could have gone on like that for God knows how long, being ignored, making myself available, swearing I was fine with how things were, too nervous to push for the boyfriend status. Or worse, I could have actually transitioned it into a real relationship. I've seen it happen. It looks miserable. I always want to scream at the guy. You let her get her hooks in so far that you married her? Did you even notice it happening? And I want to scream at the girl. This is what you put in all that work for? A husband who's utterly disinterested in you and cheats on you constantly while you turn a blind eye? Almost immediately after we ended it, I could see that I was far angrier with myself than I was with Connor. On one hand, he must have seen I was more invested than he was, and arguably he should have let me down easy in the first few weeks of knowing me. On the other, I can't blame a guy for believing me, or more likely pretending to believe me, when I insisted I was happy keeping things low-key and having casual sex. I left town a few weeks later to film an independent movie in a tiny town in Indiana. After work one night, I logged into MySpace on the slow motel internet. I'd held out on cyberstalking for a while, 2 days, and rewarded myself by looking up Connor and everyone remotely connected to him. In modern movies, the dumped girl finds out about the new girlfriend through a picture. The dude and his new girlfriend smiling on a hike or kissing at a party. I found out because Erica wrote a blog post about it. There, on MySpace, was a half-page post about the new man in her life. The most surreal part was that she'd incorporated lyrics from his songs throughout, like a sappy, stilted Mad Libs. You wouldn't know those songs, so I won't try to recreate her post. But imagine if Paul McCartney had a new girlfriend and she wrote something like this online. I knew that if I fell, it would be a long and winding road, but do you want to know a secret? I need him 8 days a week, because all you need is love. I thought my skull was going to cave in on itself. Thank the Lord that at this point in my life I'd implemented my no-matter-how-upset-you-are, sleep-on-it policy regarding conflict. I drafted 10 different emails to Connor. They ranged from furious, wounded, 2-page diatribes to the classic single, wow. It's a dangerous word to send to an ex. Ostensibly restrained and dignified, but in reality self-righteous and petulant. I slept on it, and in the end I sent nothing. My poor co-workers in Indiana never heard the end of it. Despite my moaning, the casting crew were really supportive. They didn't know the situation, they had no obligation to cheer me up. But on days I was mopey, the director would say, "My landlord back in L.A. just called me and told me there's a toothless prostitute named Erica, with a K, hanging out behind the dumpster in our alley, and she's offering handjobs for $1, but no one's taking her up on it." "You've never even seen a picture of her. I know you're trying to make me laugh, but she's actually really pretty." "Yeah, you're right. She's pretty for a toothless prostitute who hangs out behind dumpsters and smells like a pile of dead rats." "Oh, yeah, he said she smells like a pile of dead rats." It's amazing the way this over-the-top and uncalled-for meanness warmed my loathsome little heart. It's a strategy I've followed, perhaps at my peril, when my friends go through similar scenarios. I know it's childish and lame, but it feels good, and you're allowed to be a miserable shit for a while after you get dumped. You know your ex and his new girlfriend aren't evil, but it's easier to feel like they are. Breakups can turn fully dimensional people into stubborn little vessels for your most stubborn little feelings. It takes a while for them to change back. Very recently, a strange thing happened. Someone who still knows Erica brought her up to me. I cringed. That bitch. "You know she still thinks you're pissed at her." This gave me pause. She still thinks what? How does she even know me? I was 20. I was a mousy girl she met one time. I assumed she hadn't even caught my name. I figured she didn't know I was a person. But I realized, oh my God, I'm not pissed at her. I'm so not pissed at her. I literally have no feelings about her. In fact, I don't think I'd recognize her if I fell over her. "Oh, hello, fully dimensional human. You're free to leave my brain now." It was a real lesson in my endless capacity to hold a grudge. I do it so well I don't even notice that it's happening. I walk around with these calcified resentments for years until someone points them out and I can go, "Good Lord, is that still in here? Let's get rid of that." And throw out pretending that watching boys play video games is fun while we're at it. I had to take a moment to wonder who else fell into this category of default enemy. I went through a mental list of people who, in theory, I'd want to hit in the face with a meat tenderizer. My coworker from 10 years ago who owes me like $3,000, It was 10 years ago. You were addicted to OxyContin. Go. Be free. My 7th grade teacher who told me that most child actors don't succeed as adult actors, you just wanted to scare me into having a backup plan. Farewell. Good luck. Tori from 4th grade who accused me of writing mean stuff about all our friends on the playground wall. Burn in hell, Tori. I know it was you. I'm still working on it. Guys in LA. Like so many of us do after we've been dumped, I decided I could redeem myself by examining the choices I'd made and vowing to do the exact opposite from then on. I entered a classic phase of post-breakup overcorrection. This lasted about a year and came in two waves. First, I became intensely wary of guys. I wasn't going to be made a fool of again. I once made plans with a sweet-faced bartender, and when he innocently asked to reschedule, I said, "You know, where I come from, this is called being blown off." Where I'd come from? Did I think I was from the Dukes of Hazzard? Second, I wanted to exact my revenge on men in general. I realized that modern flirting was essentially just being mean while smiling. I hadn't mastered the whole getting people to like the real me thing, but insulting someone to their face, that I could do. And it seemed like the more attractive the guy was, the more he liked being insulted. We'd meet, I'd be charming, i.e. unnecessarily mean. We'd go on a few dates, I'd trick him into thinking he was in love with me, and then I'd stop returning his calls. I wanted to punish someone for how I felt, but it never helped. It was stupid and unwarranted. I guess I felt more in control for a while, but I soon realized I was no better than the cliche geek from high school who grows up and bones as many girls as possible out of spite, which really took the fun out of it. By 22, I was back to business as usual love-wise, alternating between being contentedly alone and scaring off anyone I actually liked with my intensity and desperation. I did, however, implement a new rule. No discussion of the number. I'm happy to say that only a few years on, guys stopped thinking it was okay to ask me how many people I'd had sex with. I don't know if that change was a reflection of my age or the quality of men I was seeing, but there was a time when, if a guy had known me for more than 24 hours, he thought it was his right to know my complete sexual history. This is a trap for girls. I always felt embarrassed about my late start in the sexual world, but the fiasco with Landon had taught me that you could be labeled slutty after having only one partner. Was my number too high or too low? And what did this information measure? An STI is an absolute. You either have one or you don't. And while a doctor can tell you that, knowing someone's number cannot. Outside of a health concern, the question seemed designed only to shame and discourage promiscuity. And if that's the case, why just intercourse? Why did no one ask, how many people have touched your boobs? Or how many penises have you seen? Or did you ever hump a swing set in the first grade when no one was looking? The logic is, I must avoid even responsible protected sex with someone new because it affects my number. But this dude can go ahead and stick his face in my vagina because who's counting? I decided that I would not engage with this ridiculous and arbitrary metric. Footnote. Some dudes like to say that men have the instinct to spread their seed while women are supposed to protect their reproductive organs from everything but the best sperm for the strongest potential offspring. By that logic, every woman in the world should be saving herself for Dwayne the Rock Johnson and never letting any of you shitheads touch her. Seriously, you guys should stop using that argument. The first time I implemented this new rule, I'd been seeing a guy for a couple weeks. He asked, and I said something like, "I've decided to stop answering that question because I think there's no answer that a woman can give without being judged. If it's a health matter because you'd like to have sex with me, I can get tested and show you my results." I fully expected that when I said this, the guy might assume I'd had so many partners that I was embarrassed to reveal the number. But I figured if that weeds out the kind of guy who infers shame from reticence or thinks sexually active women are disgusting, all the better. He took me up on the offer and we both got tested, which I respected. So far, so good. What I didn't count on was him pretending to be cool with me not answering while letting it fester and take on a life of its own. He brought it up several times in the following months. He never asked about my previous relationships or my attitudes about sex or intimacy or fidelity. He wanted the number. I understood that if I simply told him that by his count he was number 3, it would have brought him some comfort. But I didn't want to give it to him. He wanted some assurance that I wasn't too experienced, but I didn't want to comfort someone who found that objectionable. When we had our first big fight, his true colors came out. Slut. Whore. I'll bet you were molested when you were little. Charming, right? He was barking up the wrong tree in terms of trying to hurt me, but at least now I knew who I was dealing with. In related news, infomercial voice! Ladies, if you ever date a guy who shows up at your apartment uninvited, or calls you from someone else's phone when you block his number, or inspires you to attach a little can of mace to your keyring, tell your friends. They will help you. If a guy threatens self-harm, or tells you that you're the crazy one and all your friends are on his side, they aren't. Your friends want to help you. And if you start talking yourself out of it because you're worried about looking overdramatic or vindictive because, I guess, he hasn't ever hit you. No! Don't do it! Don't talk yourself out of it! Your friends don't need you to get hit to want to help you! Yay! Moving on. Back on the horse. More recently, a friend of mine tried to play matchmaker for me. She proudly told me that the guy was reluctant to be set up until she showed him my picture. Of course, the picture she showed him was from a GQ shoot where I happened to be blonde, backlit, and half-naked. I texted her. Me. Dude, please get back to him and tell him to prepare to meet, like, a human woman. I did not know I would be attempting to live up to the expectation of a solid 3 man-hours from a team of hair, makeup, and lighting professionals. Sarah. Oh my god, stop! You're being ridiculous. Me. Let me do my impression of this guy's evening. Oh, I don't know if I'm ready to meet anyone right now. Wait. You didn't tell me she was a half-naked blonde with baby oil all over her legs. Let me Febreze my going-out shirt and call an Uber. Then, oh, what's this? She's wearing clothes and isn't looking at me with lust in her eyes. I shaved my balls for nothing. Please tell him that since this photo was taken, I have dyed my hair back to its natural, mousy shade, and I have eaten several sandwiches. He didn't show up. I found that guys like to show off on the first few dates by talking restaurant managers into letting us in at closing time, or hiking in restricted areas, or sneaking into movies. These guys underestimated how much I love rules. Also, while I love a good round of dirty talk, I don't enjoy body talk. A lot of guys didn't understand that. For a while, it seemed like men thought that pointing out that they had a penis would inspire some amazement on my part. I once told a guy I had to wake up early, and he said, I could wake you up with my, sir, I'll stop you right there. That is the least sexy thing you could say to me. Nothing about you is sexy when you're the reason I'm awake. You're basically an iPhone alarm with a pulse. And I don't want to fuck my iPhone. At least not at 7 a.m. But I get mine. For a while, I had a fling with a guy who was so good-looking, I think he was as confused by his interest in me as I was. The physical stuff was always great, but his perpetual expression was one of profound confusion. He obsessed over my body, but it seemed like it was because he was trying to locate the homing device that was scrambling his brain. I felt like saying, I know, buddy, I don't get it either, but for now, let's get you back to work. Something amazing happened to me when I hit my mid-20s. I don't know how it happened. I didn't even notice it at first. But I stopped liking guys who didn't like me back. In fact, I stopped liking guys who were bad people. I wish I could impart some concrete advice on how to achieve this. Because I have to tell you, it's incredible. When I first realized this was happening, I didn't want to mention it to anyone. I didn't even want to fully acknowledge it to myself. I thought I might jinx it or scare it away. How many times have I thought, wow, I guess I'm really at that point in my life where healthy foods are more appealing, only to end up face down in a plate of melted cheese and maple syrup. I thought I was destined to fall for assholes forever. Misanthropic and 15 years my senior? Sign me up. Makes misogynistic jokes but thinks I'm feisty for calling him on it? It's love. I'm still not certain I'm out of the woods. You never know where life will take you until you're awake at 4 a.m. dissecting text messages from a guy named Jordan who has a Wolf of Wall Street poster in his bedroom. But I think I might be done finding shallow and sad people attractive. It's paradise. Pretty in Pink was wrong. You can fall in love with Ducky. A couple of years ago, I brought my boyfriend to a friend's weekly Game of Thrones viewing party. As the episode started and we all settled into our seats, two of the male attendees started whispering to each other. Oh my god, dude, you know who's on this show now? Diana Rigg. Wait till you see her. They seemed positively gleeful. These two grown men were giggling like bitchy cheerleaders at the fact that a woman who was once a sex symbol had the audacity to turn 75 and, gasp, be on TV. I reeled from witnessing this exchange, and as I prepared to ask just what the hell that was supposed to mean, my boyfriend chimed in. Oh, Diana Rigg, man, she's been on the last few episodes. She's brilliant in this, right? My sweet boyfriend didn't even notice when the two men shot each other smug, that's not what we meant, buddy, glances. When we left, I told him, you realize what you've done, right? You've just expressed that it's possible for a woman you don't find sexually attractive to have value. I think those guys might think less of you now. Really? I hate those guys, so that would be great. I've still got stuff to work on. If a guy can convince me that he has answers or a better plan than me, I will follow him anywhere. I've fallen for it more than once. It's not easy to pull off because I happen to think that most people are idiots, but if you can do it, I'm in trouble. I would follow a confident woman just as blindly. However, in my experience, women are less comfortable pretending to know what they're doing when they don't. I've been on the other side of it, too. I've met the guy who is young and talented and wise beyond his years and still looks to me for advice. What an ego trip that is. It took an older man saying point blank, I like giving you advice for me to realize that, yes, that's the bit you like. Not being helpful to me, but the sound of your authority reverberating in the ears of a younger woman. It's not that deep down I want someone to take care of me. It's that I'm exhausted and occasionally overwhelmed by self-doubt. I'm steering the ship, but I don't know what I'm doing. None of us do. But it would be so nice to believe that someone out there did, and that maybe they could take the wheel for a little while. It's a seductive feeling. It would be great if it were real. But I guess I've got to count on myself. Which is not great news. Hollywood. Fashion. Suit up. In third grade, my fashion hero was Claudia from the Babysitter's Club books. She was into fashion and junk food and art and being Japanese. I was into the first two things, so I figured I could model myself after her. I used to reread every description of her outfits, usually found in chapter 2 where the POV character describes the other club members, and I compiled them all in a notebook. When my family went to the mall, I'd stay on the lookout for things like purple high tops and printed turtlenecks. Unfortunately, the books were written in the mid-80s and it was 1993, so my fashion hero was pretty 5 minutes ago, but would be right on point today. What's that? The mid-80s are out again? And the mid-90s are out? 2002 is in? Wasn't that like 3 years ago? Since I could never find what I needed to precisely recreate Claudia's every outfit, I settled for coveting the most absurd-looking articles of clothing at Contempo Casuals or TJ Maxx. I was 8 years old at this point, and my mother had a brilliant plan. Occasionally buy me a stupid-looking outfit, let me wear it, and I'd get it out of my system before I got to high school. For the most part, stupid-looking was the worst offense. Stretch pants with sequined piping from my brother's Michael Jackson Halloween costume, a sweatshirt with an iron-on applique and puff paint, a massive faux mother-of-pearl daisy necklace. You know, stupid-looking. Some of it, though, was hilariously provocative. My favorite piece was a black halter top that tied in the back and around the neck. Over it, I wore a sheer white collared shirt with black velvet polka dots tied up at the bottom. I looked dope. I think I even wore it in our class picture. On its intended customer, this halter top probably would have shown off the navel and full abs, as well as a generous helping of cleavage. On me, the 8-year-old fetus, it covered my entire torso, almost up to my neck. It was equivalent to a toddler wearing an actual dress Paris Hilton got upskirted in. They'd smell like a stripper, but they'd look like a nun. It caused something of a stir among the other parents. They'd chirp to my mother, "Wow, you let your daughter wear a halter top to school?" "Yeah, why not, right? If I tell her what to wear now, she'll just want to rebel even more when she's 16. "Oh, what a neat idea. It's not for me, though. I could never let my kid dress like that." "Okay, but $10 says she's going to start dressing like a tramp the second she gets boobs." Mom would actually wait to say that to me in the car, but it was still awesome. Even at 8, I knew it was pretty pathetic for someone else's parents to care about what I wore. Perhaps it should have prepared me for my current state of affairs, where my clothing is the subject of professional debate for equally unaffected people. Bring on the critique, fashion police. My mom's gonna have a wicked burn all lined up the second you turn your back. When I got to middle school, my style was informed by the rise of two movements: grunge, which had finally hit Maine, and my personal self-loathing. Even in the summer, I wore long sleeves because a schoolmate gently pointed out that the hair on my arms was dark and revolting. It's gone away now after years of waxing and perhaps sheer force of will. If you still have dark hair on your arms, maybe you don't hate yourself enough. My mom told me that she had dark hair on her arms as a kid, but that it went away as she grew up, and the same thing would probably happen to me. That doesn't help me right now, idiot! I'm a monster! I made sure to find clothing that covered as much real estate as possible. For the most part, I had to shop in the kids' sections of JCPenney and L.L. Bean, but large children's sizes kept me plenty covered. There was an especially unfortunate plaid bucket hat and a daisy-covered wallet with a chain. The memory of this wallet chain pops up whenever I've been feeling too good about myself. I mostly used clothes as a means to avoid detection. It's like I thought that if my shirts were baggy enough, I'd be mistaken for a pile of laundry that moved from class to class. In high school, clothing became armor. Other girls dressed to accentuate whatever they were working with. Since I was working with nothing, I relied on my flared corduroys and a revolving collection of lewd t-shirts. Now, some of you will have to trust me on this, but there was a time before every douchebag had a Jesus is my homeboy shirt when printed tees were an actual novelty, especially to Mainers. Around 14, I discovered a store called Yellow Rat Bastard. Shut up! That store used to be cool! Every time I went to New York for an audition, I'd find my way to Prince Street and buy a funny and occasionally obscene t-shirt. The shirts were always too big for me, so they hid the fact that I had the measurements of a hairless cat, and they were rude, so they gave off a real, I could dress in cute clothes if I wanted, but I'm above it vibe. One had a picture of Pee-wee Herman captioned pervert. Another had the cast of Baywatch and the word orgy. I layered them over long-sleeve waffle tees and took on the world. I can't feel bad that I'm not one of the pretty girls if I'm actively making myself look weird. Loophole. I wanted to be sent home for my inappropriate clothing. Badly. True to form, though, I was terrified and filled with regret the only time a teacher mentioned it. When Abercrombie and Fitch came to the main mall and created a scramble among the wealthier kids to prove they could afford it, I shoplifted a shirt and wrote, Am I popular yet? Across the chest with a marker. Suck it, fashion. I'm not your bitch. Sometime during junior year, my friend Sam told me that when guys walked into a room, they scanned the girls and picked out who they'd have sex with. He explained that it was like a reflex, so I'd love to get some feedback from guys on whether that's true. Just tweet me or leave me an Instagram comment, or if you see me in the grocery store, definitely just come up and let me know. When I asked if I made his list, he shrugged and said, Yeah, you're always on the I would side. I think you're probably on most guys I would side. This was great news. Given the choice, with no effort required, guys would rather have sex with me than not have sex with me? This changed everything. I mean, I still didn't want to have sex, but you're saying that if I did, I wouldn't have to promise to wash the guy's car to get him on board? The revelation that in spite of my boy chest and braces, I wasn't considered a monstrosity led to about 8 months of really sad attempts to highlight my double A cups and gel, my hair into submission. Turns out that trying to look as pretty as you can and still not being a pretty girl does a real number on you. My waffle tees were more comfortable anyway. Audition closet. Reverting back to my homely by choice tactic served me well when I moved to Los Angeles. I'd never seen people this good looking. I know lots of people say that LA is full of tall blondes who make you feel like Quasimodo's ugly cousin. I know it's unoriginal and feels like a cry for attention, but when you're in an audition to say one line in an episode of Entourage, you can't help but think, even I would cast this part on looks alone, then scan the room and regret using your last quarter for street parking. Maybe I had to compete with these girls at auditions, but I was not about to battle the changing tides of style in my spare time. Boho Chic is in, you say? Cool. I'm gonna go buy a SpongeBob jacket from the boys section of Target. My closet looked like the byproduct of schizophrenia. When you're searching for an acting job, you never throw anything away because, you know, what if there's an audition for a futuristic businesswoman who happened to spill ketchup on herself earlier that day? And if something is cheap enough, you'll buy even the most hideous garments for the same reason. Your personal clothing is less than half of what you own, and no matter how strong you are, you will end up wearing something regrettable like your spoiled homecoming queen audition outfit to a party and take a photo with your friend Lacey where you're both obviously sucking in your stomachs. Maybe your photos will be higher than 3 megapixels, but it will happen. For the most part, though, I was happy with my sartorial choices. I thought I looked cool. Maybe I did. Or maybe I looked homeless. Either way, it didn't occur to me that adults who weren't auditioning or on a date could wear decent clothes. I once went to dinner with Aubrey Plaza, and when she showed up in a skirt and a little white blazer, I thought, is she going somewhere after this? Enter the stylist. The Twilight premiere was my first experience with a stylist. Actually, he was more a friend of a friend who told me he could convince some less reputable showrooms that he was a stylist, but he was willing to work for free, so the job was his. He got me 3 dresses. The pink one was too small, the silver one made me look like the world's saddest sex robot, and the black one sort of fit. We decided on the black one. After the premiere, a costume designer friend told me he'd seen a picture of me in a magazine. You looked cute. You were wearing this kind of kooky black dress. Kooky? Yeah, it had a ruffle around the collar and kind of a kooky bell sleeve. It had a ruffle around the collar? It had sleeves? All I had noticed was that it was a black dress, and it fit me, and it didn't make me look like C-3PO's slave wife. I had thought of it as the safe option, as the little black dress. Turns out someone who knew stuff about clothes immediately identified it as eccentric. Lucky for me, he seemed charmed by it. I'd gotten away with taking a risk on my first real red carpet. Also, I was the 37th most important character in the Twilight movies, so no one gave a shit anyway. When Up in the Air was chosen to premiere at the Toronto International Film Festival, Paramount Pictures hired a professional stylist for me. I suspect word had gotten back to them that I enjoyed dressing like a teenager who lived in her car, and while that was spectacularly endearing, it would be in their best interest to have someone help me dress like an adult woman. I wanted to do whatever I was supposed to do to promote a movie of that caliber. And I was excited about the prospect of playing dress-up in free clothes instead of begrudgingly spending money I needed for Panda Express at Bay Bay whenever I got invited to something. Since the movie wasn't out yet, and to fashion people, indie films don't count, my stylist was effectively working with someone who had no credits. To be honest, I don't understand how styling works to this day, and I've given up trying to figure it out. I think part of the ambiguity comes from the stylist wanting to protect you from the harsh realities of the fashion world. If I mention in an email that I think some designer makes especially beautiful dresses, and my stylist never gets back to me about it, I can assume she